Sky News Centre at 5. David Cameron has confirmed he wants British troops out of Afghanistan within 5 years. The Prime Minister is in Canada for his first G8 summit of the world's richest leaders. This week has been one of the bloodiest for British troops in Afghanistan, with 8 fatalities. Mr Cameron's told us he wants soldiers home by the next election.
I want that to happen, make no mistake about it. We cannot be there for another 5 years, having been there for effectively 9 years already. But one thing we should be clear about, Britain should have a long-term relationship with Afghanistan.
A man's been convicted of taking part in a £40 million jewellery raid. Aman Kasai stole gems from Graff Diamonds in central London last August. The 25-year-old was found guilty of kidnap, conspiracy to rob and possessing a firearm. The jury is still deliberating on 6 co-defendants. Our reporter Alistair Bunkle says Woolwich Crown Court heard Kasai forced a shop assistant to help him.
Kasai pulled out a handgun and by threatening the manager of the shop, he made him lie on the floor and he made one of the female assistants put into a bag 43 items of jewellery.
A woman who falsely claimed she'd been gang raped has avoided being sent to prison. Sarah Hunter made the allegation to avoid being punished for wrecking her boyfriend's car. She was given a suspended sentence at Coventry Magistrates. £67 billion has been wiped off the value of BP shares since the start of the oil spill disaster in April. The fallout from the leak in the Gulf of Mexico has sent stock plummeting to a 14-year low. Brazil and Portugal have played out a goalless draw in their final World Cup group game in Durban. Both sides are through to the last 16, the South Americans, as group winners. And Roger Federer is back on centre court at Wimbledon. He's looking to kick-start his campaign against Arnaud Clément in the third round. Elsewhere, there have been wins for Leighton Hewitt, Novak Djokovic and Venus Williams. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year,
by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and my guest to look at Chancellor George Osborne's emergency budget and review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the 6 o'clock news, as another aid flotilla sets sail across the Mediterranean heading for the Gaza ghetto in occupied Palestine, details of last month's Israeli commando raid are still trickling out. We hear from Shakir Yildirim, one of two Bristolians on board the aid ship, and from British film director Ken Loach, for their views of the media coverage. And Ken Loach's view, he asks, are the Palestinians terrorists, soldiers or freedom fighters? Neil Evans is here to examine the medical justifications for the proposed Badger cull, and is there a secret government in the West? We hear from assassinated US President JFK as well as the Florida computer science teacher David Shedrow. He believes he's identified a private club that virtually controls the US government, and he also reveals they have an equivalent here in Britain. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, this weekend looking fantastic, actually. Very hot, around about 24, 25 tomorrow, and fairly, with a little bit of cloud tomorrow, but very hot, up to 30 degrees Celsius on Sunday. Next week, average is going down a little bit, back to 24, 25 degrees in the daytime. A dry week, generally, with plenty of sun. Tuesday is looking the cloudiest. And on to next weekend, that's the 3rd and 4th of July, averaging 20 degrees Celsius in the daytime, a little cooler with some rain on Saturday, sunny on Sunday. So if you want to go out and about with the family, make sure you do it this weekend, because it looks like it may be a little bit drizzly next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, how long have you been a councillor in Bristol?
25 years.
And what inspired you to get involved in politics?
Being in the trade union movement in the first instance. And
which trade union were you in then?
Well, I was in what was ASTMS, is now Unite. And seeing and taking issues through to a certain level for people that needed somebody to speak for them. You reach a level where you have to go somewhere else to be able to really make a difference. And so it was either Parliament or local council.
So that's quite a while to be spending in local politics. What have you gained, do you think, personally from it? What lessons from being a politician?
Well, a few lines of grey hair, as you can see. But satisfaction in being able to make a big difference to a small group of people over those years that struggled with bureaucracy and the system, that were in desperate need of help, and be able to deliver that to them was very satisfactory.
And on the other hand, what do you think you're able to offer? I mean, what are you yourself able to offer as a politician?
As a politician, well, one, I'm available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year, and two, I'm prepared to listen to people.
Okay, now, can you tell us also, are you, you sound like a Bristolian, are you actually born and bred in, here in Bristol?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
17 Hampstead Road, Brislington.
Okay, and when you were in the trade union, were you a trade union official or were you a worker, a shop steward or something like that?
I went right the way through from member, shop steward, regional representative for both Bath, Bristol and Exeter universities, and then went on to the national negotiation set up for universities for about 5 years.
And what do you actually do down in, or up, I should say, maybe, in St George West? Well, what's your, do you have surgeries and things like that as a
yes,
counsellor?
Yes, I have a surgery on the first Wednesday of every month from 7 o'clock. Nobody needs an appointment, and then we run it until we either run out of people that want to say anything. Or
Whereabouts?
In the St George Labour Club, opposite the St George Library.
Okay, I'm also joined, as usual, by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, we've heard today that British banks are being advised to keep large reserves of cash to protect them against possible currency failures, and that potentially this means that they're, again, this is a reason for them not to be lending money out. Why is it that they're being told that they should be keeping large reserves of cash?
Well, because there's a fear that we're going to go into a double-dip recession and that the banks will be weak, so they're being told to hold larger reserves of cash in order to protect them. It's pretty pointless, really, because in a sense the banks are all insolvent, their books are cooked. There's an element of make-believe in all of this, frankly.
Why do you say that, make-believe? This is quite important for someone who's wanting a loan from their banker.
The banks,
being told, no, we can't do this.
The banks aren't loaning because they're private sector institutions dedicated to private profit. No sensible private institution is going to lend in the current climate. That's why they're not lending. A state-owned bank or a nationalised bank might have a different set of priorities, but they're not, in fact, functioning in that form. And therefore, most of the money that they've been given to kind of prop them up has basically been used to write off existing debts. It's not to be lent on to anybody. There's no realism about the fact that they're bankrupt, and that's one of the problems that we face.
Now, it's a big week this week with the emergency budget George Osborne delivered in the House of Commons, and at the same time, pretty much as that was going on, there was a rally here in Bristol at College Green outside the Council House. Martin, I think you were down there, were you?
I was, yeah.
Can you just tell us what went on?
Well, it was a rally originally coordinated by the Convention of the Left, but we talked to lots of different trade union activists in the city, and we decided that we would have some kind of protest on Budget Day rather than just letting it pass. And we had a reasonable crowd for the time of day, and we did make the news, TV news, so I think it was worth us doing it, basically.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen now, because you very kindly took one of these our wonderful little recorders down and recorded some of the speeches, because we very rarely hear the speeches that are made at these big public rallies on the radio. So let's have a listen now to what was going on earlier this week on Tuesday afternoon outside the council house.
I think one of the key things here is we have to be proud of our public services. I am sick to death of hearing negative comments about public services and being compared to the private sector. The public service is not about profit. That is the difference. The public service is about providing those services for the most vulnerable within our community.
We stood here and we burned our poll tax bills. Some of you were there that day, I can see you in the audience. And we were told in 1990 that Margaret Thatcher was invincible, that everybody in Britain must pay a poll tax, which would mean taking out of our pockets more than most of us could afford. And we said, no. No, we won't do it. We will stand together. We will build a movement of non-payers which will turn your flagship into your Titanic. And that is the confidence that you have when you decide to get up off your knees, stand on your feet and work together. Other speakers have said it. We're not going to be played off one against another, one community against another community, one trade union against another trade union. This is about all of us saying, thus far and no further. 20 years ago, we burned our poll tax bills. We took a pledge we wouldn't rest until Thatcher's poll tax was hated history. 20 years on, I take another pledge today. I won't rest, and I know you won't rest, until we repel these cuts, until we have politicians representing us instead of politicians who bleat either that they can't do anything or who just decide to cut our jobs and services. It's decision time. I know which side I'm on. Let's come back here in a few months' time. Let's have thousands of people on College Green. Let's make this city shake to the message that you will not cut our jobs. You will not cut our services. We will see you out of office first. Thank you.
That was recorded earlier this week on Tuesday afternoon, Budget Day, outside the Council House and College Green. Martin, this is all sounds very like much like fighting talk, but at the end of the day, if your paycheck isn't paid, you're not going to turn up for work, are you? Really, the employers, that is, in this case, mostly public sector employees, the government, have the whip hand, don't they?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. What we've got to do is we've got to move towards struggle directed at a national level. We're not used to that in this country. Even the miners' strike in the 80s was essentially a sectional struggle. In other parts of Europe, and I'm thinking particularly of France, when you want to change government policy, everybody has to jump simultaneously and everybody has to act together. And the public sector does in fact aggregate a large section of the workforce as a core for such kinds of activities. We've not really done stuff like this before, not since the 1920s, but we've got to start thinking in this kind of way, because government policy can be changed, but you all have to act simultaneously. You can't be picked off one by one, as is traditionally the way in the way we organise our trade union activities in this country. I don't know what Ron thinks about that, but that's the way I see it.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that. The problem that we've got, of course, is that since, particularly from Margaret Thatcher onwards, the ability of trade unions to actually coordinate and organise any form of protest, national movement, etc. We saw it in the miners' strike, where government took on a union deliberately to smash it. The inability to get collective support, it's called flying picketing in 84, 85. All that has been taken away. How many times do you have to go to a ballot before you can actually take industrial action? How many people can you have on a picket line, etc.? The old methods from 1920, 22, the general strike, whatever, mass movements like that are very difficult to organise now legally. I'm afraid we're in a situation where you cannot see public services decimated, and I can understand why people feel motivated or indeed passionate about it.
Well, one of the speakers there was talking about back in the the late 80s, early 90s, burning our poll tax bills.
Well, I burnt mine.
Well, yes, but at the end of the day, that's not going to really achieve anything, isn't it? You just get taken to court and you have to either pay a fine or go to jail.
Ah, yeah, well, I burnt mine on the basis that the pensioners in my ward didn't like what was being paid in their bill for people that refused to pay entirely and wanted some form of protest movement. So I got myself summoned deliberately and burnt my bill, but actually paid it 24 hours before I burnt it. When I went to court, you were asked three questions. One, are you X? Yes. Do you live at Y address? Yes. Is this debt yours? And I said no. And they said, why not? And I produced a receipt and I got an apology. But I told my pensioners to keep their payments back, about £5 a month it was, in their own bank account, get some interest on it, but pay up at the end. And so that was a campaign we ran in St George.
But it was kind of a waste of time, really, because the poll tax didn't arrive, as it was actually called, the community charge. What happened instead was something called the council tax, which essentially is pretty much the same thing. It's levied per person, whereas the old rates used to be levied on the house and on the landlord. So really, it didn't change anything.
Well, it was a pernicious tax, and I think the ability to be able to campaign on that was one of the big issues that got rid of one of the most dangerous women in British politics, which was Margaret Thatcher at the time. So I think there was some benefit came out of that debate.
OK, well, anyway, let's now go back to Tuesday again and have a listen to the first of several clips we've got of George Osborne. And this, I think this one, the first clip we've got, is he's talking about something called sovereign debt. Martin, what is sovereign debt?
Well, it's the debt that countries owe rather than companies or individuals, although it's been a bit blurred of recent years because we've been bailing out the private banks.
Mr Deputy Speaker, this emergency budget deals decisively with our country's record debts. It pays for the past and it plans for the future. It supports a strong enterprise-led recovery. It rewards work and it protects the most vulnerable in our society. Yes, it is tough, but it is also fair. Yeah. This is an emergency budget, so let me speak plainly about the emergency that we face. The Coalition Government has inherited from its predecessor the largest budget deficit of any economy in Europe, with the single exception of Ireland. £1 in every four we spend is being borrowed. What we have not inherited from our predecessor is a credible plan to reduce their record deficit. This, at the very moment when fear about the sustainability of sovereign debt is the greatest risk to the recovery of European economies.
I feel that he's attacking the wrong thing. The debt, the deficit, is simply a symptom of the crisis. It's not that it can't be, that it can be ignored. I mean, the deficit has to be dealt with one way or another, but it's simply a symptom of the crisis. And in actual fact, the reason why our deficit is bigger than others is because we've got a bigger private banking sector to be bailed out. And of course, you don't actually want to cut public expenditure in order to solve the deficit, because that actually cuts demand in the economy and then forces down economic growth. You actually want to continue with economic growth, which means that you've got to actually raise taxes on wealth, and that's exactly what he's not talking about.
Ron?
Well, yes, I mean, the issues around the introduction to that budget is totally fallacy. I mean, it's not fair. And it's not helping those that are desperately in need of help. It's old Tory policy, and I think for once the Labour front bench got it right in the first sentence when they stood up to oppose the budget.
Okay, let's have a listen to the next clip now from Tuesday's budget emergency, indeed, budget speech by George Osborne.
This budget is needed to deal with our country's debts. This budget is needed to give confidence to our economy. This is the unavoidable budget. The truth is that the country was living beyond its means when the recession came. And if we don't tackle pay and pensions, more jobs will be lost. And that is why the government is asking the public sector to accept a 2-year pay freeze.
This is all misconceived, completely misconceived. There is the problem we face is not immediately one of the deficit. The deficit is a problem, but it's not the major problem. The problem, the real fear, is a double dip recession. Now, you must avoid a double dip recession, because if we get into a further downward spiral, the deficit will increase. So what they're actually talking about will not, in fact, decrease the deficit if they crash the economy. And of course, they shouldn't be focusing on the deficit. That is sleight of hand. They've made everybody think that the problem is Britain owes too much money. The problem is that the private banks have collapsed and nobody knows what to do about it. But now they're coming out with this stuff where most people are not educated about economics, and therefore they're easily bamboozled by this. Oh, we're in debt. That's the problem. The problem is the collapse of the private sector financial system, and that's what they're not talking about at all.
Ron, George Osborne there is saying that we're living beyond our means. Now, Martin's suggesting actually what needs to be doing is a bit more borrowing until we're out of the recession, but that is continuing. In fact, it's making things worse. If we did that, we'd be living even further beyond our means.
I didn't say carry on borrowing. I said raise taxes on wealth.
Okay, sorry. All right. But don't you agree with Osborne that we are living beyond our means at the moment?
Well, no. What I think's happened, I mean, he's saying that they need to have pay freezes and look at pensions. But whose pensions are they looking at? They're not looking at his, are they? Or indeed the people that are well off. What they picked on is their traditional area, the weakest in society, the people with the lowest wages, the people that can't defend themselves, etc. And an interesting fact I found today was that in the last 12 months, there was £240 billion actually went into savings in this country, and there was only £200 billion actually spent. And that's as the recession has come in, people have got more careful with how they spend it. And so I don't think he's right. And what we see in that is the potential for a shrinking economy. And I was speaking before we came in. And the danger is that if you go into public sector services in the rate that they're going, with the suggestion as they made in Bristol, £35 million cuts over a three-year period, you end up in a situation where in such a short period of time you do get into a double dip recession. The economy suffers, banks suffer, the pound suffers, and everything else that goes with all the bits that's attached to that. And it's the wrong way to approach this particular issue.
But Osborne's being really prudent, isn't he, by saying we're going to have a two-year pay freeze in the public sector, because that's one thing he does have control of. It means that that's actually set in stone, and hopefully there won't be strikes and industrial action in the public sector once he's said that we're having a pay freeze for 2 years.
Well, that's not the position. That's not the position of the public sector unions. That's not the position. They say they're going to resist, and they'd be right to resist, because it's actually taking demand out of the economy. You don't want to take demand out of the economy. That's foolishness. The whole basis of this debate, that we need to cut public expenditure, is simply wrong. We probably need to increase public expenditure, but not through borrowing. We need to go to the people who've done so well out of the bubble economy over the last 30 years, many of them sitting in the Tory cabinet and the Liberal Democrats as well, and we're going to say to them, you're going to have to pay a big chunk of your wealth over to the government to sort out this mess. You've done very well out of the previous policy. It's now time for you to pay up, not us, you.
Well, the next announcement by George Osborne was that he's going to be freezing child benefit for 3 years.
I know many working people feel that their child benefit is the one thing they get without asking from the state. So instead, to control costs, we've decided to freeze child benefit for the next 3 years. This is a tough decision, but I believe it strikes the right balance between keeping intact this popular universal benefit while ensuring that everyone across the income scale makes a contribution to helping our country reduce its debt.
Well, I mean, as Ron said a moment ago, who are we picking on here? We're picking on children, the next generation. This is foolishness, and it's not even going to work. As I said, cutting these benefits, cutting public sector pay, that money goes into local shops. It's then spent on from local shops to wholesalers and suppliers. The sense of how the economy actually fits together is not there in this kind of policy. you can't just cut money here and then you've just cut that bit of money and that solves your problem. Because, of course, the people that used to get that money won't spend it in somebody else's inbox. And this then forces you towards a double-dip recession. And we're seeing this, the whole of the G20 are being bamboozled down this road by what used to be called in the old days a banker's ramp. Basically, the bankers have said, we've got all the money, you've paid it all over to us, now you've got to cut back so that we don't have to. Now, that's wrong, and that's what we've got to nail on this. This is class warfare from the top, and we've got to give it back to them in spades.
Well, one thing, Martin, that you might be pleased with is Osborne's next announcement, which was a levy on the banks. I suppose it's a kind of windfall tax, really, and also a rise of 20% in VAT.
From January 2011, we will introduce a bank levy. It will apply to the balance sheets of UK banks and building societies and to the UK operations of banks from abroad. There will be deductions for Tier 1 capital and insured retail deposits and a lower rate for longer maturity funding. Smaller banks with liabilities below a certain level will not be liable for the levy. Once fully in place, we expect the levy to generate over £2 billion of annual revenues. On the 4th of January next year, the main rate of VAT will rise from 17.5% to 20%. The years of debt and spending make this unavoidable. This single tax...
Order!
The years of debt and spending made this unavoidable. This single tax measure will, by the end of the Parliament, generate over £13 billion a year of extra revenues. That is £13 billion we don't have to find from extra spending cuts or income tax rises.
Now, Ron, I imagine you will be pleased with the bank levy, but what about the rise in VAT from 17.5% to 20%?
I think this is the most misguided and pernicious part of the budget because it is so intrusive on everything. Everything you buy, every service that you hire or buy in, everything has got VAT on it.
But VAT is a very cheap tax to collect, apparently, compared to some of the others like income tax.
Well, so it might be, but what I'm saying is, at the same time, I said, who are they picking on? You're getting people with two-year wage freezes. They claim they didn't put any increase in the price of fuel, but there's VAT on fuel. And that goes on delivery costs, etc. And I asked a question today, what was the VAT bill for the City Council? And people scratched their heads, but I did get a result. We actually pay £60 million in VAT, but the bulk of that is actually reclaimable by the City Council because it's on services that we have to provide by statute. But there is a section of services that we charge where we're in competition with the private sector. This is things like collecting trade waste from the shops and restaurants, pest control. If you want something extra and something different in relation to the services that you get in crematorium and our services there in cemeteries. And that would increase it from 2.9 million that we have to pay to the government to 3.3. So people hadn't thought of that. And that's an extra £400,000 that's got to come and be found out the City Council's £35 million cuts.
Now, I find the VAT quite annoying because it's called value-added tax, but actually it means that value is taken away from everything you buy. Martin, what's your thoughts on bank levy, first of all?
The bank levy is too little, too late, and is just a fig leaf for the fact that they're not actually doing anything serious to tackle the wealthy criminals at the top of the system. But, of course, he used that before he launches into the VAT, which is the meat of what they actually want to do. The point I would make about VAT is it's a regressive tax. Poor people pay more proportionately of their income in VAT than wealthy people because it's on everything they buy. And, of course, wealthy people don't pay VAT on lots of things they buy because they're buying foreign yachts and what have you. And income tax is a much fairer tax than VAT. Although, in actual fact, what we really need to see is wealth taxes now. Income tax is not going to be enough to plug the hole in the budget. We need to go back to the level of wealth taxes we had in, say, 1948 or something like that. This is an emergency. They're trying to tell us it's an emergency. If it is an emergency, it's time for the wealthy to cough up, as they were made to do in World War II and its immediate aftermath. That's how big an emergency it is. And VAT is just... It's going to actually squeeze demand in the economy. So you're going to cut people's wages, make things more expensive. Are they going to go out and spend? No, they're going to save, because as you pointed out earlier, there's more people saving now than ever. Now, that is natural enough, because they've got to cover their debts. But in that case, it's only the government and government expenditure which can lead the economy out of the recession. It won't be led by the private sector.
Okay, Osborne's next announcement was about relinking the basic state pension to earnings.
I can today announce that from April next year, we will relink the basic state pension with earnings. Now, pensioners can say with confidence, they will also be protected by our new triple lock, which will guarantee each and every year a rise in the basic state pension in line with earnings, prices, or a 2.5% increase, whichever is the greater. There will be no more 75 pence increases in the basic state pension.
Well, this is something I actually agree with. This is quite sensible. We were pushing for this for many years under a Labour government. The Pensioners Convention and Jack Jones and we're talking about this for many, many years. I think that what they're doing there is they're trying to throw us a few crumbs to make the rest of it seem more palatable.
Yeah, but the problem is what are they linking it to? Because it's the consumer price index rather than the retail price index. And the...
Can you just explain the difference between the two?
Well, I can't explain the exact difference. It's a measure as I understand it, of measuring, if you like, what we spend and average cost and price rises. But the CPI tends to be much lower, and it excludes things like household costs, council tax, and mortgage payments. And let's face it, that's the three biggest issues for any... working family in this city. And if they're out of that basis, then the chance of the pensioners getting anything in relation to a sensible rise in their pension linked to that is going to be very much lower.
Okay, let's listen to Osborne's summary now then.
Sadly, with this unavoidable budget, we have had to increase taxes. We've had to pay the bills of past irresponsibility. We have had to relearn the virtue of financial prudence. But in doing so, we've ensured that the burden is fairly shared. Today, we have paid the debts of a failed past and laid the foundations for a more prosperous future. The rich is paying the most and the vulnerable protected. That is our approach. Prosperity for all. That is our goal. And I commend this budget to the House.
I don't believe that we're going to get prosperity from this budget. What I suspect will happen is that, as Danny Blanchflower, who used to sit on the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, is saying, I'm now 100% certain there's going to be a double-dip recession in Britain. That will actually increase rather than decrease the deficit, but we will also lose output in the process. At a certain stage, not too far distant future, they're going to carry out a U-turn and they're going to start spending money as they watch the economy disappear like ice cream in the sunshine.
Yes, but the banks are now, at least we hope, starting to lend much more to the public. To the private sector.
They're not.
And that is going to carry the economy forward, surely.
That's what they claim, but it's only ideology. In actual fact, the private sector is drawing in its horns. The private sector is in debt up to the hilt. Basically, if we were to allow the market to work, a huge chunk of the private sector would disappear in bankruptcy. And we're not allowing the market to work. We've actually propped up the banks. But if you do allow the market to work, then a lot of the private sector will simply disappear, and it will not lead a recovery. It never did in the 1930s, and it won't do now. The state must lead the recovery. That's the only way, because the private consumer is saving more, the private sector is indebted. The private sector is not to be abolished, but it will never be the dominant force it ever was in the previous generation. We're going to go back to an older setup where the state basically decides the level and direction of economic growth, and the private sector tags along like a poodle behind. And that is the only way out of the recession. Anything else, this 1930s orthodoxy which they're coming out with, it was discredited in 1933, what they're talking about today. Discredited in 1933, but they're still coming out with this is 2010.
Ron, I mean, what George Osborne is saying essentially is that this is this part been passed irresponsibility by the Labour government, and that what he's doing now is he's trying to square things up and make it a fair, level playing field. Would you agree with that?
No, definitely not. I mean, look at the issue, and coming back to the problems of private companies and recession, why is the government stopping kickstart? This is the ability for the government to lend money into companies like Bovis, which were local here, which rebuilt our prefabs, but gave us some social housing as well, kept that company going, restarted work, kept people in a job, supported the local economy, and trained apprentices in skills and benefits in the building industry. But they have stopped that stone dead. Why? Because it is ideology, and it's not. And that's the sort of investment that the Labour government put into trying to motivate people to get skills and training, and also to help and assist the economy against the problems of the World Bank. But who's it fair for? I mean, I don't know if you've seen, but the latest set of expenses are out today, and it makes some very interesting reading, because David Cameron, in the last 6 months of 2009, claimed £12,978.88, and that is mostly on his constituency home, £8,205.53, of which we paid his council tax bill of £208. His mortgage interest dropped from £1,081 to £822, and we still paid his home insurance policy at £71 a month. Now, if he gets a public sector pay freeze, he's laughing, isn't he? Because we're paying his bills for him. But the people in my ward, in Speedwell and other places, are facing huge price increases that they will inevitably get through VAT. They'll be looking over their shoulders, trying to wonder whether they're going to have a means of paying anything at all and be put out of work. And I don't think this is fair, and I find the last statements in that budget summing up completely and utterly false.
One person who's also having to pay the price for this is the Queen, and we're told also that her civil list payments are going to be frozen this year too, not just the public servants public servants pay being frozen, but the Queen's too, at £7.9 million per annum. I'm not quite sure how long that's going to stay frozen for. What do you think about the civil list payments, Ron?
Well, obviously, I'm sorry, but from how patronage and privilege has come to the monarchy over a period of time, I think the civil list needs reducing. I would agree with that. But in the same issue, I think we still have to keep fair wages for people that carry out whatever duties they do for the monarchy.
Because the Queen's a big landowner in her own right,
exactly.
Etc. So it does puzzle me why she needs an extra £8 million from public purse.
In the circumstances, I don't understand that at all. When you look at some of the costings in relation to air flights and private hire and things, other things that have been put in there, I think there is... A similar position that could be looked at in reviewing that. And so, I mean, the Duchy of Cornwall is very close to us, at Newton Park and out that way, with loads of land and pasture. I don't understand that. And that's probably about the only thing I'd agree with.
That's Prince Charles's estate, I think, isn't it?
Well, I know, but it's all part of the monarchy and the civil list, isn't it? It's still the same principle. Where do you stop?
Okay, now, what with the budget this week and with the football, it's one of those weird weeks where I think, well, I'm looking in amongst a lot of the broadsheet newspapers this week thinking, I wonder what bad news is being buried this week, because it's been kind of swamped by the budget and football. Mm. And one of the big stories is this plan that's come out in the last couple of days by Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark, who said that he wants to close 157 courts in England and Wales. A move apparently could save £15.3 million a year and a one-off maintenance backlog bill of £21.5 million. So it seems that the Justice Department is being asked at the moment to pay £21.5 million just to get our all of our courts up to scratch, and by closing 157 of them we would save £21.5 million. And as part of those closures, the local courts, which they're talking about going to some sort of vague consultation before it actually happens, but by closing is in are in Frome and in Bridgewater. Martin, what do you think about this whole thing of closing courts? This is magistrates courts, crown courts, family courts and county courts.
Well, I presume that the level of expenditure we have on courts at the moment is there for a reason, because there's a certain amount of business that they have to do. So the obvious conclusion you might draw from this is that they won't be able to get through the business that they're supposed to get through. And, you know, things will clog up as a result. You know, things that need to be settled will hang fire for longer.
Well, I've been looking at the news actually last week in California, which has got a tremendous budget deficit and all sorts of financial problems, that they're saying there that actually it's very difficult to get a court case heard in California now. Even paying your parking bill, some people are having to queue for a day and a half to pay their parking bills, and if they don't pay them, then they get bailiffs sent round. So I mean, I don't hope that sort of thing doesn't happen here, but I mean, is this a symptom of the recession then, just the fact that many of our big important public services, including the justice system,
well,
are suffering?
I mean, I don't know if any the listeners have seen a very interesting documentary about Detroit, which was Requiem for Detroit, which was shown, I believe, on BBC Two or Channel Four, was it, some months ago. But effectively, society is breaking down in big American cities. There is no police, there's no courts. People basically have to take justice into their own hands. The only way to deal with people who are robbing you is to shoot them first. And, you know, we're moving towards a Latin Americanization of Northern America. And then Britain is going to be drawn into the same game, are we? Where we don't actually have any courts to sort of solve any problems. So people are going to solve the problems out on the street without the courts. No schools, no fire brigade. That's happening in the US. Right across the US.
What are your thoughts on these court closures? We hear, like I say, Frome and Bridgewater courts to possibly be closing within the next 6 months or so.
Well, it's an issue which, again, the City Council looked at when we were looking at making major cuts, because we had 52 buildings in use, and the attempt is to reduce that to 17. So it's a common place to go and look for savings. But I think the issue that Martin raises is correct, in as much that you have to look at the geography and location and the ability of people to be able to get service, and in relation to maybe fines or court cases and hearings that they may have to attend. So I think on the basis of the courts and being on a much wider geographical spread, I think it's harder to get that right. I think, again, this is something that's being led by accountants rather than by people looking at the necessity of the service.
Well, one other side to this, of course, is that we're talking about 157 courts around the country. Now, all of that is public land, and public money can be raised by selling off those closed courts, can't it?
Well, yes, and that to some degree there may be a reason for closing one or two. I think it says here that I think it was Jack Straw looking at 20, but that's not 157. So I think you need to be careful that you don't actually make the service that is actually being carried out in a building incapable of being available to people and actually producing what you're actually putting the main part of your money into.
Another story this week. The NHS target to see your GP within 48 hours has been axed in a government move to save millions in bureaucracy. Patients will face a longer wait to see their GP after a controversial target that everyone should be seen within 48 hours was scrapped at the beginning of the week. The pledge is only one of many facing the scrap heap, as Health Secretary Andrew Lansley made it clear that Labour's much criticised target culture is being abolished. Now, this tick box culture, Martin, I think, you know, many of us are really frustrated by this. And actually, that, you know, there could be something positive here in that doctors and nurses can just carry on and get on with doing their jobs rather than having to tick boxes the whole time.
Well, obviously, the target culture has been pernicious in the public sector for many years in education and in health. But, of course, the target culture has been imported from the private sector. Doctors never used to have to bother about things like this at all. This whole idea that that private sector management is the way to do things, you need to have something measurable in the private sector. So they've created things that they can measure. But in actual fact, a lot of what doctors and teachers and social workers do isn't measurable in those terms and never was. And in the past, they were trusted to get on with it. They've been overwhelmed with all of this target culture because they're trying to ape the private sector, that private sector which has just gone bust because it's been so mismanaged, that private sector.
Ron, I think another one of the targets that's gone is just this week, is this thing of actually getting treatment within 2 months at a hospital. That now is out of the window too. How do you think that's going to affect people, patients, you know, part of the NHS?
Well, obviously, anything that slows up treatment or, if you like, preventative approaches to any health issue is deplorable. Clearly, there are waiting lists, and we have our own problems with assessing elderly people for assistance at home in the council. But the issue is not the fact that we haven't got the ability to do that. Is the problem is that we have problems in holding on to staff because we have to pay a wage which physiotherapists in particular is uncompetitive with either private sector hospital or health provision, and we have to keep retraining people. So the issue is that people will end up waiting longer and potentially, depending on what their health issue is, may be seriously putting their lives at risk because the queue is getting longer.
Just to correct myself, it's actually an 18-week referral target, that is from the doctor to be seen by a specialist. And the other target which has gone is the 4-hour target to wait at A&E, so we could be maybe waiting longer for that. But let's just, to be absolutely fair, what still remains is the 31-day cancer target. That is, everyone with cancer will get the treatment they need within a month of seeing a consultant. And the 2-week breast cancer symptom target and an 8-minute ambulance wait. Those are all the targets which will remain. Plus, finally, the most a 48-hour wait to be seen at a sex clinic. Anyway, public sector pension review is also happening. There's lots going on at the moment. Martin, what is all this about public sector pensions? Why is there a crisis in public sector pensions where we kept being told about?
There isn't a crisis in public sector pensions. This is, again, a false impression that's being created.
Because we heard from John Prescott, didn't we, that the guy who's looking into all this, Hutton, John Prescott called him a collaborator, even though he's in the same party.
Well, I let's see what Will Hutton comes up with. I mean, I'm a bit surprised that he's taken Cameron Schilling, but nevertheless, we'll see. This public sector pensions can't be afforded. Most public sector workers, of which I was once one, are in receipt of minuscule pensions, tiny pensions. Nothing like the pensions that George Osborne and David Cameron can look forward to from all of their connections to be on various boards. And, you know, we were talking about expenses. These people are on boards other than they're doing things other than their main job. Now, hang on a minute. Can you do that? Can you be a cabinet minister and still be on the board of all these other things? Apparently you can. And they'll be drawing salaries from that and pensions from that. Don't forget that pensions are also what pays for the good life for people once they reach a certain age, and that money is spent in the economy and keeps people at work and so on and so forth. So cutting pensions for people at the bottom end is not actually very sensible economics. It's going to make the economy crash. If we need to raise money, we must raise money from those who got it. And that's what's absolutely lacking from all of this analysis. We can't afford this, we can't afford that. We can afford anything we want, but we might have to take some more money off the people at the top end. And that's not what's being discussed here, is it? They've made a mess, but we've got to pay for it. It's quite clear this is class warfare from the top. It's quite clear what they're doing.
Now, Ron, do you think there actually are enough people at the top with enough money to do what Martin says here? To actually take as much money as possible from the elite, if you want, to pay for some of this stuff, rather than to be clawing it back from some of the poorest in society?
Well, right at the beginning, Harriet Harman said that when she responded to the budget, it's the same old Tories, same old targets, same old story. And that's totally right, because when the going gets tough, it's not the people at the top that the Tories ever look at or target. It's always the people at the bottom. And I would fight hand, foot and finger for public sector pensions, because it's, in effect, it's deferred pay for the people that have given probably, you know, 20, 30 years of service to the people of this city. And they are not highly paid, as Martin said. And certainly, if you look at the pension benefits from the bankers, for example, who failed the system, who were irresponsible, got bailed out, and then got a golden handshake on top of that. That's where we should be aiming to make savings, not at the level of the low pay.
Okay, Afghanistan, briefly, but this week we've had the 300 victim has died from the armed forces. It was a really fiery edition of BBC's Question Time last night, with Peter Hitchens really laying into many of the people right across the different parties, saying, what on earth are we doing there? I know you're very much against the whole occupation and NATO action in Afghanistan, Martin, but what about you, Ron?
Well, I think it's becoming more and more difficult to understand what the role is anymore. I think previous attempts to, if you like, bring some form of democratization to Afghanistan has always failed, and the Taliban has always come back, etc.
Well, what many people will say is that there are terrorist training camps over there, and that's why we're there, to stop those terrorists training and then getting planes or boats or whatever over here.
If it's going to take umpteen number of deaths of our young people to try to achieve something which appears to be going nowhere, I think, to the bulk of people in this city, then I think it's time for a rethink. And, the Obama has said that he wants to look at the issues, etc. I think that's right. I think it's time for an honest appraisal of why we're there, and is it worth the price? Because I don't think the lives are worth the price.
Now, our Taunton commandos seems to be taking the brunt of this right now. That is 40 commando based just is it Norton Fitzwarren, just exactly outside Taunton. And it's all rather close to home, isn't it, Martin? If you were a family or member of one of the families from Taunton, from the commandos, how would you be feeling right now?
Well, you better ask them rather than me. I obviously opposed the war from the very beginning. I think the reasons we've been given for it are entirely specious. What we're really looking at here is a geopolitical game, with the Pentagon trying to get bases so that they can threaten their potential enemies in Iran and Russia and China, and all the stories we've been told about bringing democracy and women's rights and so on. I just think it's a lot of piffle. That's not really what they're interested in. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is now one of our enemies, was our ally. Rashid Dostam in the north, who was our enemy, is now our ally. So we've switched sides completely in 20 years. And do you know what we've been doing? We've been spending millions of pounds of British taxpayers' money to wreck Afghanistan. And it's a shame and a disgrace. And of course, the soldiers are just caught in the middle of all of this. I can't see, just from a practical point of view, how they think they're going to win from a situation like this. Any objective analysis of it is that they're going to lose. The Russians lost at about this stage of the game. They ran out of puff about 10 years in. We're running out of puff.
We've also heard this week that the UK special envoy to Afghanistan, as part of the diplomatic service, he's called for talks with the Taliban, and now he's now resigned. He was known for his scepticism about the Western war effort and his support for peace talks with the Taliban. But he's just stepped down a month before a critical international conference in Kabul. Or at least some of our diplomatic staff, it doesn't seem, are up for staying in their jobs even anymore over this. Either of you want to respond? Maybe Martin. Who is this chap anyway?
Well, I mean,
Sir Sherard Cowper-Coles. He's on extended leave, we hear, this week.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people, Peter Galbraith, who's an American diplomat, and there was also a military chap whose name I've forgotten now from the American side, who said, look, what you've got in Afghanistan is 120 different groups fighting against us. So when we use the word Taliban, we're using the word, it's a shorthand. The internal documents that NATO are using refer to their enemy as AOMs, anti-occupation militias with a plural. And in actual fact, what we've got there is lots of different groups who don't like foreigners of any kind coming into their area, especially not ones who don't speak the language, especially not ones that are from completely the other side of the world with a different culture. We hear about British soldiers dying, but if you read on the internet the Pakistani news, you'll see that there's all sorts of airstrikes going on, allegations of torture, paramilitaries, American and Afghan, running wild, killing people, raping, stealing. These are our allies, and we can't really hold our head up with allies like that. It's time to cut our losses, both moral, material, and human. It's time to go.
It seems like quite a lot of the diplomatic staff, even some of the army officers privately and the soldiers privately, aren't really interested in Afghanistan. The only people who are really pushing for this, and of course the army are doing their duty, doing what they're told by the politicians. Yes. At some point, surely the relationship between the politicians and the armed forces is going to snap.
Well, it depends what level of the armed forces you're talking about, because, of course, there's also been lobbying about we need more helicopters and so on and so forth. One of the reasons McChrystal is so unpopular in the US armed forces is that he said you mustn't just shoot.
This is the guy who's, yeah, the guy who's been removed this week.
Is that he basically said we've killed thousands of Afghans and most of them are innocent, so please will you not just shoot back when people shoot at you? Now, of course, the US military are used to when somebody shoots at them, they just give 360 degree fire. So anybody's in the area just gets killed. Now, that, of course, protects the lives of your soldiers, but it doesn't win the war in terms of hearts and minds of the people you're fighting. So McChrystal has been saying in public that they shouldn't do that. But in practice, he's been running death squads in the middle of the night. People go out and cut people's throats in the middle of the night. They're still cutting the wrong people's throats because your intelligence is so weak. You don't know who's fighting who about what. It's not your country. You don't really know what's going on the streets of New York. So why do you imagine you know what's going on around here is beyond belief. And really, the whole thing has just become a huge boondoggle for the arms industry and a career path for various generals who never go to the front line. And of course, it's absolutely unwinnable. The Russians are smiling behind their hands at all of this because they went through all of this. They went through it all. They learned their lesson. Have we learned our lesson? They're doing exactly the same things in exactly the same order as they did in Vietnam. And the result there was defeat, just as the result of their economic policy is going to be depression. There's no way out for them. They are, in fact, trapped in these two ridiculous policies, but there's something he's going to give.
Ron, what about your view on this relationship between the armed forces and the politicians? Do you think at some point it's going to give?
Yeah, I think there's a strain in that already. I think in relation to the fact that the armed forces has been of necessity and by budget and other issues reduced and expenditures reduced, but expectation in relation to where they may operate is extended. You know, the Royal Navy ended up in a situation where they virtually only had about two ships in Portsmouth or around Great Britain at one stage. I think there is a tension between what is expected of them, the role that they're expected to play, and indeed, in some cases, the quality of the equipment and things that they've been sent. And I would put the blame of that not at the government's door, but at the procurement and design issues, which has spent and wasted millions and millions, or billions of pounds.
Yeah, the SA-80 rifle being a classic example.
Exactly.
Designed by a committee and built by privatised shysters, and the soldiers hate it. For good reason.
And it never works. And so I think there are all manner of tensions building up in that section, whoever the government is and whatever policy they wish to pursue.
We're going to skip very briefly over Michael Jackson's sister, LaToya, who's insisted that this is the anniversary of the death of Michael Jackson. His sister insisting that the death was murder. On to another important story this week politically, which is Chris Huhne. And he has been exposed, apparently, as having a mistress. When the pictures of Chris Huhne's mistress, this is a Lib Dem minister, were published, She looked familiar. I recognised her, says Richard Littlejohn in the Mail, from the days when we both used to work for Sky News. Funny, I thought to myself, I always had her marked down as a lesbian. Turns out I was half right. Karina Trimmingham is bisexual. Even though she's currently sweating up the sheets with Hune, it's not that long ago since she married her lesbian lover in a civil partnership ceremony. Do you think it matters, Ron, that Chris Hune has been cheating on his wife?
Well, obviously, I think that's a matter between the two of them, but I personally would find that a problem or a shame. But I think the sexuality of people in public office, I think if, providing they're honest about what their sexuality is, that's fine. But we've seen instances of other ministers that haven't done that and have done that to their detriment.
Martin, quickly.
I think what we've got a problem here is that everybody expects that politicians have to be family men. I mean, this is the main thing that we're saying about Chris Hume now. He pushed his family in the election campaign, and now, of course, he's shown to be a hypocrite. I think we've got to get away from this whole idea that everybody's got to be a family person. Politicians are supposed to be doing their job, not bringing a family up.
OK, thanks very much for joining us, Ron Stone from St George West.
BCFM join us is the after community the news. Radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.